This is the WGBH Forum Network.
I'm really delighted to welcome David Richards, the author of this wonderful book today, and our speaker, who's going to be talking to us about the Poland Spring Resort and its connections also to the Boston area, which are very interesting. He is the director of the Northwood University Library. So please help me in welcoming David Richards. Thank you.
I want to thank Michelle and the staff of the Old South Meeting House for inviting me here today. Even though I'm talking about a place in Maine, it's very appropriate that I'm speaking here in Boston because there were a lot of Boston connections to Poland Spring. And we'll start off with the title slide. And what we're going to do in the course of this is eventually wind up answering the question why this is called Poland Spring, A Tale of the Gilded Age, and not Poland Spring, A Tale of the Victorian Age. So as we go along, I want to make some contrast between Victorian ideals and the new Gilded Age ideals that begin to come about in the period after the Civil War. I always like to get a sense from my audiences, their knowledge of Poland Spring. I assume many of you are familiar, if not most of you, with Poland Spring from the standpoint of the water, and there's the modern logo that they use saying the water has been sold since 1845. You've probably seen lots of these bottles around. It still does come from Maine. I was asked that question this morning. It still does come from springs in Maine, actually more than just from Poland Spring itself. If you look closely on a label, you'll see the different sites throughout the state of Maine where they get the water from. But it's actually owned by a multinational international corporation, Nestle. Nestle has a subsidiary here in the United States they call Nestle Waters North America. What they've done is gone around the country and bought the most popular spring waters in each region. Poland Spring is the number one bottled spring water in this country. It's not the number one bottled water. Aquafina and Dasani, which are the Coke and Pepsi products, which are not spring waters, are the number one and number two products. But Poland Spring is the number one bottled spring water. So it has a lot of cachet, a lot of historical background to it, and it's a very successful commercial brand today. And you can see Nestle still use that tagline, what it means to be from Maine. So very much trying to connect to Maine, to nature. You see it in the logo, the hills, the streams, the forests, part of what makes it a very popular brand today. Now, another aspect, and the one that I'll be more focusing on today, is the resort era, which begins after the Civil War in earnest, although the family that ran the resort took in passersby beginning in the late 1790s. This is what it looks like today. Have any of you stayed at the Poland Spring Resort? A couple people here. It still is a going concern today. And you see two of the buildings. They actually have quite a few different options of where people can stay. Most of what is there now in terms of where you would stay is newer construction, 1950s, 1960s. The old, only historic hotel that is still left is what they now call the Presidential Inn, which you see pictured right here, which was built in the early 1900s as the third resort that was part of the hotel, that was part of the resort complex. I'll be showing you pictures of the other two. This is an overall view of the resort in the 1950s when they were advertising it as a 5,000-acre resort. So it was quite a considerable amount of property. You're not seeing all 5,000 acres there, but you're seeing most of the built part of it. There's 28 different sites that are identified. And we're going to be talking about number one, which is where the water came from, and to some extent still comes from. The bottling plant today, where much of this water comes from, is not far from number one on that map. Number two, the Poland Spring House, we'll be talking about. Number three, the Maine State Building. Number five is the site of what was called the Mansion House. One of the reasons I want to start with this slide, in terms of the historic portion of the talk, is that eventually what the family that owned this resort started calling it was a city of vivid contrasts. And one of the points I want to emphasize is that it really was a little city unto itself. And you get a sense of the scale of that in these buildings that you see here. Altogether, at the height of the resort, and this is a little after the height of the resort, this is the 1950s, the height of the resort would have been the early 1900s. There was about 100 buildings altogether when you start counting in all the outbuildings that were needed to keep the resort going. It really was a city unto itself. But the other aspect of it is them identifying as a city of vivid contrast, because what they're really trying to do is appeal to two different ideals. One, a modern ideal. People coming here would be coming from the city, and they'd be expecting certain conveniences when they got there, certain urban amenities to follow them to Poland Spring. But on the other hand, they were very consciously leaving cities like Boston to get away in the summer and to come to a place like Maine. So they're also looking for some anti-modern qualities to their visit. They want it to be very nostalgic. They want it to be very rural and pastoral and to connect them very much to nature. So that was really the ideal that the proprietors were trying to serve, this idea of the vivid contrast, the anti-modern and the modern influences in the post-Civil War era. And that's what I'm going to be highlighting as I go through the next couple slides, which are really going to be talking about the place of Poland Spring. And the final part of the talk will be looking at the people who came to Poland Spring, many of whom were Bostonians, and that's what I'll really be emphasizing. So first I want to look at some of the architecture and how some of these ideals I've just been talking about were embodied. And the first building is the Mansion House. Now, this is the building that the family that started the resort, called the Rickers, first built when they moved to this area in the 1790s. And at first, it was just this section right here, a 2.5-story building. And they were located right on the county road. So what they found is that there would be passers-by who would be looking for places to stay as they came down out of the mountains of Maine to head down to Portland. And very early on, the Rickers started taking in guests and started an inn and a tavern as well. The resort era doesn't start until after the Civil War. And in the 1860s, they started to take on more guests. And what they did over time, as you can see, is they kept adding on to the Mansion House. But this was still the oldest structure on the site. It's where the Ricker family resided as well as took in guests. So this became the embodiment of the nostalgia, the colonial revival emphasis and influence of the post-Civil War era. When you'd go in there, you'd see the old-timey fireplace. The building had been made out of nails that the Ricker family themselves had made, and the chimney and fireplace was made out of bricks that they had made right on the site. So it had a real colonial, nostalgic quality to it. So people coming to Poland Spring at this time would have been people who were going out and joining organizations like the DAR, the Daughters of the American Revolution, or the Mayflower Society. And one of the big interests at this time period was genealogy. This is something the Rickers would promote, and they had a library at the resort, and they'd put genealogical books in there, and there were places where you could order family trees, and maybe one of your summertime projects as you're at Poland Spring would be to fill in some of this information. But then you can also see some of the modern influences coming in. You see out in front of the Mansion House, you have people on bikes. Bicycling is another activity that becomes very popular in the 1890s. By the 1870s, there were so many people coming to Poland Spring that they couldn't accommodate them all in the Mansion House. So they had to build a new structure, a second hotel on the property, which they called the Poland Spring House. Now, when they originally built it, and I have a slide later on of what it looked like, it's essentially just this section right here. But again, over time, as the resort became popular and more people wanted to come, they just kept adding on wings. And you can see the different wings over time that got added. And actually, there was a third wing that you don't see here that comes off the back. So it was actually in the shape of a U, not in the shape of an L. They could accommodate between 400 and 500 people in the Poland Spring House once it had reached its maximum extent, about 200 to 250 people in the Mansion House, and then later on you have that third hotel being added in the early 1900s. So when it was a full-blown city, altogether there'd be about 1,000 patrons who'd be coming, and then you'd probably have 300 to 400 workers there as well. So you're talking about 1,400, 1,500 people that could be there in the height of the season. Now, the Poland Spring House was advertised as the mecca of the fashion, the wealth, and the culture of the country. So again, it gives you a sense of what they were trying to appeal to. the types of people that they're trying to appeal to. Poland Spring wasn't quite at the level as a resort area like Bar Harbor or Newport, Rhode Island, or Saratoga, New York. That's where the super wealthy went in the Gilded Age of America after the Civil War. The next rung down was places like Poland Spring or the hotels of the White Mountains, of which there were many, dozens and dozens on the White Mountains of New Hampshire, and then along the coasts of New England and down into New Jersey as well. That would sort of be the second tier. People whose names wouldn't be quite as famous today, but in their day they were very successful and prominent politicians and professionals and business people who I'll be talking more about some specific examples. Again, showing how the modern influences are coming in, one of the things that becomes very popular is the idea of recreation and leisure. And here out in front of the Poland Spring House, what you see is the first golf tee. Poland Spring was one of the first resorts to have a golf course. It came in 1896, and they came up with a very snappy slogan, "Golf is king at Poland Spring." So it gives you, again, a sense of what they're trying to promote at Poland Spring, what the reasons are that people should want to leave the city and come to a place like Poland Spring in the summertime. So now we're going to move more into the landscapes that were created at this resort to try to appeal to this urban clientele. One of the ways that you would come to Poland Spring, most prevalently, would be by railroad. And you'd come from cities like Boston, New York, Chicago, Philadelphia. And you'd come up to Portland, Maine. And then from Portland, you'd come up to a couple different depots and junctions where you could come to Poland Spring. But the last leg of the journey would be to come in a carriage or a coach. Here you see a carriage right here. Very strategically, what the Ricker family would do is bring you up past the source of the water. At the far left is the spring house, and that's actually the spring house that still stands at Poland Spring today. You can go up and visit it. Next to it is the bottling plant that was built at the same time in 1906. And again, Nestle has set that up as a museum, so you can go and visit that and take tours through. And then off to the right-hand side are warehouses for the bottles of water before they get taken to the railroad depot. So very strategically, the Rickers would have the coachmen and the carriage drivers bring you right up past that and probably make a stop right away at the spring so you could get some water from the moment you got to Poland Spring. Because part of the reason for having the resort, which was only seasonal, which was only 10 or 12 weeks during the summertime, was to get you drinking the water, going back to the city, and ordering the water throughout the year. So those 10 or 12 weeks are hopefully building up your interest in the water so that you will order it for 52 weeks. The water is where they really made the money. They sort of broke even on the resort aspect of things. So partly what you're seeing here is what's becoming a very commercial landscape and even in some extent an industrial landscape. You have a physical plant here that's bottling water. But part of the appeal for people coming from the cities is the pastoral landscape. And I'll talk more when I'm talking about some of the specific people who came to Poland Spring, why that pastoral landscape was so appealing to urban people. And here's a good view of it. This is a painting done by a Maine painter called Delbert Dana Coombs, who loved to paint cows. And here you see a good example of one of his cow paintings. What you have to bear in mind, and we may actually have the right dimensions of it with this big screen, it's a 4-foot by 6-foot painting. So it's very dramatic when you look at it. And it's called Calling the Cows. Now the cows you see here would have been cows that were part of the resort's dairy herd. With all those people staying at Poland Spring, with all those workers there, there's a lot of people that need to be fed. And they tried to produce as much of the food as they could right at the resort. What you have in the picture in the background are two buildings. At the far left is the cow barn that was built in 1898 to be a state-of-the-art facility for housing the cattle and for milking them. This is a time when there's a great concern about the quality of foodstuffs in America. A lot of it's very contaminated. A couple years later, Upton Sinclair will write a very famous book called The Jungle, where he talks about the meatpacking industry. It's a time when America is becoming very conscious that they're food and beverages are not handled in very safe ways, and that's one of the reasons that you have diseases and sicknesses breaking out in cities. So the Rickers tried to assure their patrons that they bottled their water very safely, that they took care of their cattle in a very healthy way, and that they had a state-of-the-art facility for milking them and for storing the milk. And what's interesting is, again, this is very much a pastoral scene. You have the cow barn in the background, but juxtaposed against it on the right-hand side is the Poland Spring House, which again is the epitome of fashion and wealth, and culture, modernity, and luxury. So again, this idea, the vivid contrasts are captured right here in this painting by D.D. Coombs. Another important appeal was nature. People want to leave the cities and come back to the rural parts of Maine to get very close to nature. This is a piece that was put together by a man named George Haynes, who lived in Portland, Maine, and his business was what was called a descriptive writer. Essentially, he was a travel writer. And what he did is he had a business where he would write these promotional catalogs for different organizations in Maine, usually the railroads that owned different resorts throughout Maine that they wanted to attract people to. This is one that he was commissioned to put together for the World's Columbian Exposition, which I'll talk about in a while. And this is a page devoted to Poland Spring. And so he puts the three most important buildings, the Poland Spring House, the Spring House, and the bottling plant, before the 1906 one. These are earlier ones that were wood structures, and then the mansion house right here. But what he's also showing you, and what he describes in the write-up, is the nature that you're going to be exposed to. And essentially what they talked about, these descriptive writers and the promotional writers for Poland Spring, were five different landscapes that you would see when you came to Poland Spring. The first would be the grounds. You see those around the Poland Spring House. Then you had ponds. You had three different ponds, upper, middle, and lower Rang Pond, where you could go fishing, where you could go boating. They had a little steamer. You could go out and take rides on the ponds. Then the next landscape, and this is more of a visual landscape than one that you would actually go through, were the foothills as you looked off to the north or the west. And then as you looked off to the northwest, and you can see it at the very top of the page, is the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And they would very carefully prescribe of where you could go out on the veranda of the Poland Spring House, look off to the northwest, and see the different mountains of the Presidential Range. And they also talked in very florid language about what it would be like to look out at the White Mountains as the sun was setting. And that was the fifth landscape, the fifth panorama was the sky. And talk very dramatically, very poetically about the sun setting in the summertime over Mount Washington and the different oranges and reds and purples you would get depending on what the atmospheric conditions were. So nature was another important element of what attracted people to Poland Spring. Recreation was another important landscape. I showed you earlier a picture out in front of the Poland Spring House where some people were golfing. Before it was a golf course, it was the baseball diamond. And here are the first skyboxes right up here. Looking out from the verandas of the Poland Spring House down on the baseball field. And I'll talk more about this because two of the Bostonians who came to Poland Spring in the summertime were very prominent in organizing baseball. So I'll hold off a little bit more about talking about baseball. They called it the game of all games. It was very popular in the 1880s and 1890s, but then golf comes along. And what was special about golf at this time was golf was seen as a recreational activity that more people could participate in. It was limited who got to play baseball. You had to have some good athletic skills to be able to hit and field the baseball. So mostly the reason it was the game of all games was from the standpoint of being a spectator. You really didn't get to participate in baseball at Poland Spring. This was a hired team that was actually playing the baseball games. So in the early days, everyone was invited to come out and play golf. Men, women, children, they were all out there trying to hit the ball around. And in terms of landscapes and architecture, the first segment of the talk, we're going to end up at the Maine State Building. When you come up and talk to me afterwards, you'll notice I'm wearing a pin of the Maine State Building. This is actually a fairly recent photo that was taken of it because it's a building that still stands. And just to hop ahead a little bit, it originally was built in Chicago, Illinois. This is a drawing of the World's Columbian Exposition, which opened in 1893. It was meant to commemorate the 400th anniversary of Columbus coming to the New World. What it was really meant to symbolize was four centuries of progress that Europeans had brought to the New World. So it was a celebration of technology, really. And it was built in Chicago. It was quite an undertaking. They had put it together in a very short period of time. If you want a good window on what this enterprise was like, there's a book that came out about 3 or 4 years ago called The Devil in the White City by a man named Eric Larson. And he goes into great detail about what an effort, what an endeavor it was to organize the World's Columbian Exposition. Chicago was noted for its very prominent architects, and they really undertook this as a project to show that Chicago had made it, that Chicago was a world-class city. Their great fear was that New York or Washington, D.C. would get it. The Midwesterners wanted this to be in Chicago to show that the Midwest was an up-and-coming place. One of the ideals that grows out of this, and actually I'll go back a moment, is the idea of the white city. These architects had something in mind for this World's Columbian Exposition. What they wanted to show was that through urban planning and through urban design, you could construct a better city, a city that would get rid of a lot of the problems that American cities were facing at that time of poverty and crime and pollution. They wanted to create a white city, an ideal city, a pure city, by the use of design and technology. And at the end of the fair, it only went for less than a year. It opened on Columbus Day in 1893, and it ended, I think, in May of 1894. When the fair was over, the managers of the fairgrounds didn't want to be taking care of all these buildings that had been constructed. Each state was given the opportunity to construct a building. And so they were going to just tear them down. And the Rickers came along and said, don't tear down the Maine State Building. We want it. And what they did is they had it disassembled and put aboard 14 railroad cars and brought back from Chicago to Poland Spring, and they had it rebuilt and opened it in July of 1895. So in a sense, what they were doing was bringing that bit of the white city to Poland Spring, to their summer city, to their resort, for many of the same reasons. They wanted to bring those urban amenities that the creators of the white city thought were important to having a viable, livable city. They wanted it to be a place to have a library where people could go and read and reflect and maybe do some research on their family genealogy. They wanted it to be a place for a museum. You see some pictures along the wall. You see some paintings. You see a moose head. In terms of exhibits, they had lots of natural history exhibits. They had wildflower exhibits, mushroom exhibits, minerals and gem exhibits. And so you see people would congregate in the reading room, read books from the library, take in the exhibits of the museum. They had a very prominent art gallery, which a lot of the distinguished artists of the late 19th century would display their work. Was up on the third floor of the Maine State Building. This is a painting by a man named Scott Layton, who was another Maine artist. He actually taught D.D. Coombs how to paint. His student became the cow painter. Scott Layton was the horse painter. He loved to paint horses. And this is a painting he did in about 1895 called At the Jump. Again, showing you the recreational landscape around Poland Spring. In the background is the Poland Spring House. Hard to see in this room, but off to the right of the Poland Spring House is the Maine State Building. That's how we know that this painting was done after 1895. And then the fourth use of the Maine State Building was as the headquarters for the resort's newspaper, which they called the Hilltop. And a lot of the information that I've gleaned over the years came out of the Hilltop. It was published every week, and it tells the different events that were going on for that week at the resort. It also had these very interesting columns that they called tidbits, and essentially what it was a gossip column. It would tell you who was coming or who was leaving for that week, what they had been up to during that week. It was a very insightful window onto the world of Poland Spring in the 1890s. It began, I think, in 1894, and they continued to publish it into the 1920s, and later on they renamed it, called it The Tower, and that went on into the 1940s. Now we get to the people, and what I've chosen to call this section is the people of progress, because as I look through all this information about Poland Spring, what really struck me was how much these people who built this place and came to this place believed in the ideal of progress, same as those people who built the White City for the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893. Americans at this time were committed to this ideal of making things better. Now, what they mostly, the terms that they used to define that were mostly economic. What they meant by progress was more railroad tracks, more steel mills, more textile mills, turning out more cloth, producing more shoes, very discrete statistical economic measures of what progress was. They weren't quite as fast in keeping up the idea of progress being moral progress as well as material progress. But these are the people who really created the resort era of Poland Spring. Jeanette Ricker, the wife, Hiram Ricker, the husband. Most of the credit, given the times in which men were out in the forefront, goes to Hiram Ricker, and the company became known as Hiram Ricker and Sons. But in many ways, Jeanette Ricker was very important for the following reason. Hiram was very much a person of his age. He came of age in the 1820s and 1830s, a time when Andrew Jackson was our president. It was known as the era of the common man, where a lot of young men were out there trying to make their way in the world and become rich. Hiram comes down to Boston and works for a store down here, and that's where he learns business. He's down here for a year or two, and he goes back to Maine to take his business skills and try to make something of them. And he keeps coming up with these ideas of the way he's going to get rich. His first idea is that he's going to buy sheep and raise wool, because Congress has raised tariffs. Congress is trying to keep out foreign wool. It's trying to help American domestic wool producers. Hiram buys his sheep when the tariff is high. But a lot of people in America don't want tariffs to be high. Those southern cotton planters don't want tariffs to be high because they want to export a lot of their cotton. And so Congress is going to bring down tariff rates. And Hiram had bought at just the wrong time, because just as he's starting to get that wool from the sheep, the tariff rates go down, which means foreign wool can come in, which means the price of wool is going to go down. So he quite literally lost his shirt trying to produce wool. Hiram was never deterred. As many times as he got knocked down, he got right back up with his next idea. He lives in Maine. His next idea is lots of woods around. I'm going to buy some forest land, and I am going to start selling lumber. Problem with Hiram is he didn't have any capital, so he was always having to beg and borrow to get involved in these enterprises. He could buy the land, but he couldn't really then take the next step of really developing the land, of cutting off the land, because he didn't have enough capital. Undeterred, he gets involved with some business partners, and they buy a railroad that had gone bankrupt, and they think that they're going to be the ones who are going to make this railroad viable. It's a branch line off one of the bigger spur lines or trunk lines in Maine. They couldn't make any more of a go of it than the previous owners had. So the next project he gets involved with is he's going to get involved in a steamship company that's going to run a steamer on one of the big rivers in the state of Maine, the Androscoggin River. And their idea is that they're going to open up a new section of that river going up to Rumford, Maine, where there's a series of falls, three falls that drop 130 feet. It's the highest fall system east of Niagara Falls. It's going to be a great place to build mills, because of all that water power. And they're going to be the people who bring the products to and from Rumford because they've got the steamship line. They get a monopoly charter from the state of Maine, and the stipulation is they have to have a steamer up and running within 1 year or else they lose their monopoly charter. They build the steamship, they take it out on its maiden voyage, and it wrecks. It cracks up, hits some shoals. They had very aptly named it the Surprise, and there's Hiram Surprise. Now, in the course of all these ventures, he's mortgaged the property, and he is not going to be able to make his mortgage payments, and he's going to lose that property at Poland Spring. And he has to go and move in with Jeanette's family up in Rumford, Maine. And it's Jeanette's family that sustains them in those big years of his life and his business career. There's all these interesting letters within the family in which people are writing and saying, whatever you do, do not loan Hiram any money. Somewhere along the line, someone must have loaned him money because eventually he gets to come back to Poland Spring. And he's still got two more ideas. One idea is he knows he still owns the forest land up in Rumford. He knows that Rumford is going to be an industrial city. It's got that fall system. And so he decides he's going to try to start an axe factory. We'll take those trees, we'll build the handles, we'll put a metal head on them, we'll sell axes. Again, he didn't have the money really to have that venture come to fruition. So his last idea, or actually his next to last idea, is to go back to Poland Spring and start a dance pavilion at Poland Spring. And that may seem very odd. Why would people want to come to this hilltop in Maine and go dancing? Well, what he had seen is that when the railroad had come in 1848 to Poland Spring, that started to bring tourists in the summertime. And where they were going in Poland was to a Methodist campground. The Methodists would come up in the summertime and take little vacations at this campground. And his idea is, we're going to start to lure some of them from the campground over to the hilltop to go dancing. Well, Methodists and dancing didn't go together very well. So that was another failed scheme. Again, undeterred, his next idea, well, I have this spring on my property. And the cattle are out drinking from it. And sometimes we within the family have drank it and gotten well. So he decides he's going to start taking it in bottles and going to the railroad depot and when the trains come in to sell the water. And that starts to build up a clientele and a business, and over time he's able then to lure them to come and stay at his resort as well. So he's a great example of an entrepreneur of the Gilded Age, a risk taker, someone who failed six times before he finally got the idea to sell people water. And that's how he made his, not so much a fortune, but that's how he was able to build the resort. The family never really had a lot of money. They had a lot of property is what they really had. Now, also involved in this enterprise were the children. They had six children. Seated are the daughters, and at the left is Nettie, who was the youngest daughter. Nettie fancied herself an artist. She came down to Boston and studied at what was called the Cowles Art School, and then she was the one who organized the art exhibits in the summertime. She was a member of the Boston Art Guild, and she'd get some of those artists to agree to put their works on display at Poland Spring. Cynthia was the oldest daughter. She was the only daughter to marry. She married a man from Springfield, Massachusetts, so she lived down here in Massachusetts. She really didn't have a role in the resort, whereas the other five children did. Sadie was a very shy person, so they didn't give her much of a public role at Poland Spring, but she loved children. So what they put her in charge of was a Sunday school, which served not only neighborhood children, but children who stayed at the resort as well. In the back are the three brothers. They are the sons of Hiram Ricker and Sons. The oldest is at the left. That's Edward Payson Ricker, who ran the resorts, who ran the hotel buildings. In the middle is Alvin Bolster Ricker, who was in charge of the farm, which again was very important because they had roughly 1,000 people to feed during the summertime. So it was quite an enterprise for him to take on. What food they couldn't raise right at the resort, he would go to places like Portland and Boston and come down and place orders for what they needed at the resort. And then at the far right is Hiram Weston Ricker, who ran the water business. And these are the people who stayed at Poland Spring. Here they are out on the veranda reading, perhaps looking off at the White Mountains and those dramatic sunsets. The Rickers referred to them as the representative people of our country. And what they were trying to get is professionals, doctors, lawyers, college professors to come and stay, businessmen, people who owned their own businesses or were managers of large businesses. About two-thirds of the people who came to Poland Spring were from cities: Portland, Maine; Boston, Massachusetts; Philadelphia, Pennsylvania; New York City; Chicago. And as I said, most of them would come by train. The ideal would be that the mother and children would come for the whole summer season, 10 to 12 weeks. The fathers wouldn't be able to come for quite as long because they had to stay back in the city to earn money. And they would come up for what was called flying visits. They'd come up on the train, stay for a week or two, and then go back to the city. And now we'll talk about some specific people who stayed at Poland Spring, or some other Boston connections first. The financing for the Rickers to be able to develop the resort, a lot of it came from Boston. This is what the Poland Spring house looked like when it was first built. Edward Ricker didn't like it in its early form. He said it looked like a barn. And you saw what the later pictures looked to it and how they tried to add more Victorian elements to it over time. When they first built this building, they had to take in a partner because, again, they didn't have enough capital to build something like this. And they found a nearby hotel owner who helped them build this, someone from Auburn, Maine. And then over time, what they did is they got loans from local banks and from an insurance company. But in time, what they did is turn to Boston investors who helped them build it, add on to the resort, add on to the Poland Spring House. The Briggs family helped them out. And then in, I think it was 1892, a man named Nelson Bartlett becomes their prime mortgage holder. And he holds their mortgage for over about 20 years. They don't pay off the mortgage to Nelson Bartlett until 1911. They were supposed to pay it off in 1903. But they didn't. They had to extend the terms for another 8 years. Another important aspect of Boston is it's one of the important markets for their water. About in 1894, one in five of their patrons was from Boston. In 1901, one in six of their patrons was from Boston, which would have been one of the highest percentages of any city in the United States. So again, one of the ideas is you'd have people come to Poland Spring for 10 or 12 weeks so that you could sell water to them for 52 weeks. This is what they call the Poland Water Depot here in Boston, not too far from where we are right now, on Devonshire Street, 175 Devonshire Street. This is a place where you'd come in. It was like a water bar. You could drink the water right there, or you could place your water, or your order for the water, and pick up your order for the water in the city of Boston if you wanted to be drinking it throughout the year. Now, some of the people, some of the Bostonians who stayed at Poland Spring. I talked about businessmen. I said a lot of them were businessmen whose names we wouldn't know today, but this is one that you will know today. A man named James Sanborn. And James Sanborn was born in Green, Maine, and he went down to Boston to make his fortune. And this is how he made his fortune: selling tea and coffee. Chase and Sanborn. Next time you get a Chase and Sanborn can, he's the one on the right, Mr. Sanborn. And in the summertime, he wanted to go back to Maine. And where he would come is up to Poland Spring. So one of the reasons this is important is I talked about the idea of the pastoral landscape. Well, for a lot of these people, it's going back home. It's going back to the types of landscapes that they were accustomed to when they were growing up. You know, James Sanborn had been a Maine farm boy. So going to Poland Spring is very nostalgic for him. It's the chance to go back near home. Green is not all that far from Poland, Maine. Now, eventually what he does is he buys a farm of his own very near the Poland Spring house. And he's a gentleman farmer. And what he does is he raises carriage horses there, very elite carriage horses, very well-bred carriage horses. And his idea is, who's he going to sell those to? The people who come and stay at the Poland Spring House. And what they would do is they'd bring the horses over to Poland Spring and they'd parade them around the grounds and get people to decide which of those horses they wanted to have shipped back to Boston, New York, Chicago, and Philadelphia to pull their carriages in those cities. This man, Arthur Soden, was a Boston businessman. And I talked about how there were a couple of very prominent promoters of baseball who stayed at Poland Spring. Arthur Soden owned the team, the National League team, which became known as the Boston Braves. And he's most famous for coming up with a concept called the reserve clause. And what the reserve clause was, that if you signed a baseball contract with a team, that they could perpetually extend it, that you always had to stay with that team unless they let you go. And that was something that existed into the 1960s and early 1970s, before the era of what becomes known as free agency. He was the one who decided that once a player signed a contract, he had to be with that team until the team decided to terminate that contract. Now, on the American League side, you had a team that became known as the Red Sox, and that was owned by the Taylor family. Charles Taylor had been a very prominent Civil War general, and when he came back to Boston after the war, he became involved with the Boston Globe, became the publisher of the Boston Globe. The Taylor family continued to own the Globe well into this century before it got sold off to the New York Times. And his son, John, was actually the one who ran the Red Sox and built Fenway Park. But Arthur Soden and Charles Taylor would be up at Poen Spring. Now, of course, one of the things they want to see when they're up there is baseball. What the patrons of the resort would do is form an amusement committee. The amusement committee would raise money, part of the reason being to hire baseball players. This is a hired team that would play other resorts, that would play town teams, and they wanted the best players they could get. And so they got players like Louis Sock Alexis, who was the first Native American to play Major League Baseball. Legend has it he's the reason that the Cleveland Indians are called the Indians, named after Louis Sock Alexis. And they had another player named Mike Powers, who was their catcher, who went on to play for the Philadelphia Athletics. So these are college baseball players who had enough skill that they then went on to play Major League Baseball. And I'm going to conclude with a husband and wife. Reverend Adoniram J. Patterson was the minister of the Universalist Church in Roxbury, Massachusetts. And in the 1870s, he wasn't feeling well. So he decided he was going to go off to Maine, go to the Poland Spring Resort, drink the water. And he felt as though that had revived him. So in later years, he's going to have his wife, Jane Patterson, come up and join him. It becomes their regular routine that they'll come up to Poland Spring in the summertime. And Jane Patterson is so taken by this place, by their annual visits there, that she eventually writes a book called The Romance of the New Bethesda. And it's a fictional account, but it's very obviously based on Poland Spring. New Bethesda is Poland Spring. Rather than the Ricker family, she calls them the Rossville family. And it's very interesting what she has to say, because she was a very perceptive guest of the resort, and really had a good sense of some of the changes that were taking place. Again, they started coming in the early 1870s. She writes this book in the late 1880s. So by this point, she's had about 15 years of observations. And what she's very struck by is how things have started to change in the late 70s, early 1880s. And let me just read to you a paragraph from one of the chapters. With the new house. So what she's talking about is after the Poland Spring House is built in 1876. That's when she starts to see the changes. A new order had unconsciously crept in. Ladies appeared at supper table in full dress and radiant with laces and diamonds. Calico and gingham still prevailed in the morning, but every lady must look her prettiest at evening. Even the gentlemen laid aside their business suits and conformed to the new order. The at-home atmosphere, so charming 5 years before at the old stage tavern, which she's referring to the mansion house, seemed a little chilled by the invasion of fashion. She is not happy. You can't just go and have a very pleasant, easy, uncomplicated stay at Poland Spring anymore. There is now the invasion of fashion. You have to go there with your best jewelry and your best clothes, and you have to get dressed up for every meal. It's a big protection now. And someone else had written a letter, and the distinction they made is it was a transformation from the solids, the Victorians, Adoniram and Jane Patterson, to the fashionables, those Gilded Age people who wanted to make a big show and display of it all. The Victorians were much more invested in the ideals of family and home, the ideals of domesticity. And these are just some other things that are taken from the book, The Romance of the New Bethesda. In regard to family, she says, family is the citadel of true love. Home is the shrine of family affections. There is no higher calling than motherhood, no nobler career than to be the true guardian of a home. Those are Victorian ideals. That's what Jane and Reverend Adoniram Patterson came to Poland Spring for. But with the building of the Poland Spring House, with the reaching out to a new clientele, with a new era, the Gilded Age, those things were starting to change. And that's part of the transformation of Poland Spring. That's part of the reason that the proprietors tried to create a city of vivid contrast where they could appeal both to those solids and those fashionables, those who look back more to anti-modern ideals of domesticity and family, and then those newer people who are very much invested in the commercial ideas of the new Gilded Age. And I will leave it at that point since we're after one.